Investors Chronicle.
Hello, and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Dave Baxter, and today I'm joined by Hugh Sargent, fund manager for River & Mercantile, who is often closely associated with the value style of investing. That association can certainly be seen in the recent performance of his portfolios, the River & Mercantile UK Recovery and Global Recovery funds that Hugh works on have both posted substantial returns in the last year. With the value growth debate continuing to rage on and mystify us all, what better time to have a chat? Hugh, thank you very much for joining today.
Thanks for inviting me, Dave.
So I must admit, I'm always slightly wary of the value growth debate because it is so slippery. It always seems quite difficult to assess whether value stocks will outperform. And then whether that will last, we've seen some false dawns in the last decade or so. But I was quite interested, I suppose, as one way of assessing things. I saw last summer you put together a kind of 10-point checklist to gauge the prospects of value. So we had questions like, are value stocks unloved? Have smaller companies underperformed? And then other questions kind of assessing the cyclical state of the economy and monetary policy. Obviously, you know, a big kind of moment, I suppose, for markets in the last half year or a bit more now has been the big cyclical rebounds. And now we've seen that kind of falter a bit. But how would your checklist look now? Surely it's not quite as optimistic as it would be last summer.
Yeah, I mean, that's very good question, Dave. And I mean, I think if you went back 3 months, back end of Q1 this year, obviously value and recovery stocks, you know, my style had a pretty strong run. So I think it would have been difficult at that point to argue that we were still right at the bottom of the cycle for value and recovery and it was all to come. Part of it had been delivered. I mean, I was arguing at that point, we're sort of 6 months into what should be at least a 3-year return to value and recovery stock. So I'm still extremely optimistic, but perhaps not quite as aggressively optimistic as I was, you know, a year ago. But actually, over the last, 6 to 7 weeks, we've had quite a significant re-correction, I suppose, of value and recovery. We can talk about the reasons why, but you know, value stocks, cheap stocks have come back quite aggressively. Recovery stocks, reopening plays in particular have drifted off. So where we are today, and I'm just at the beginning of writing my quarterly reports, I would be all as optimistic, I think, about the return to value and recovery as I was a year ago. If you look at the kind of classic value versus recovery charts, whether it's MSCI Global Value or MSCI UK Value versus recovery, they've corrected more than half of their relatively modest rally, relatively modest in the context of 10 years of underperformance post the GFC. So half that rally or more has corrected. And therefore, we're pretty close to the bottom of the cycle again, which I think, you know, is a very attractive opportunity. And it's almost more attractive today than it was a year ago, because I think the outlook is clear. The economic outlook is clear. We are getting through the worst of COVID. If you look in the UK, the vast majority of people have been vaccinated or have over 90%, I think, have the antibodies. So we're through the worst of COVID. Economic stimulus is still extremely supportive from a fiscal or monetary perspective. Consumers are starting to spend again. Governments are ramping up green investment, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all sorts of reasons to be optimistic about the medium-term outlook for economies. Value and recovery, are, you know, B2 play are geared to that positive economic outlook. They're very geared to profits recovering. So, you know, profits have, you know, clearly been destroyed, or they were destroyed last year. If you look at margins, UK PLC back down to cycle lows and starting to recover. And those profits are, you know, geared to the economic cycle, and value and recovery type stocks are the best way of playing that exposure. And then the starting valuations are again cheap. So a lot of our, you know, a lot of the 10 point checklists that you mentioned, I think are very much in place today again. So I'm as optimistic about the outlook for value and recovery as I've, you know, been essentially as optimistic as I was a year ago, as I said, because the outlook I think is more certain.
How about the, I suppose, market appetite? Because what was interesting in the last week or so was we saw a fallback in government bond yields, and some people might interpret that in a few ways, which are not especially great for the value trade, whether it's people starting to be a bit less, I suppose, kind of worried about inflation, or kind of less bullish about economic growth, or simply kind of risk appetite falling off slightly.
Yeah, I mean, I've been quite surprised by that. But I think what happened, you know, Q1, maybe people, you know, the value and recovery trade became a little bit overbought. The inflation, reflation trade, if you looked at the amount of commentary on this, it was perhaps, you know, too much front of mind. So inevitably, I think we were going to see a period of technical retracement, and then, you know, economic numbers and indicators were just so strong that inevitably you got some rolling over in terms of those numbers, and that's likely to continue. And then at some point the Fed was going to make a statement that made markets a little bit more nervous, or just stated, you know, just anticipating some movement up in interest rates. I mean, they had to do that really, and that, you know, economies have clearly been so strong, and the US recovery is really robust. So we've had all those elements thrown into the pot, and maybe, you know, short term bond yields have maybe backed up too much. But where, and then we've had, you know, the latest phase, I suppose, of, you know, of COVID, the current variant, which seems to be very transmissible, and that's clearly, you know, caused numbers to push up again in the UK and other parts of the world. So you throw all that into the melting pot, and we have seen some greater caution about the economic outlook, which has equaled bond yields pulling back, and that's acted as a catalyst for, you know, investors to pull back from value and recovery type stocks. And then there were various other elements of that. So banks, for example, you know, having been rallying quite strongly, pulled back in the UK and around the world. And then some of the reopening plays and some of the classic consumer cyclicals, which are geared to recovery, as, you know, sentiment soured a little bit, they've inevitably pulled back. But from our, you know, perspective, that equals, you know, a significant opportunity. So while we, you know, taking tactically, I suppose, taking some profits in some of, you know, the kind of key stocks that we were buying a year, 18 months ago, which had a strong run, and we've tactically taken some profits, you know, through Q1, you know, those are the stocks that we're putting capital back into today, I would say, pretty aggressively, really, in anticipation of a return to our value and recovery type stocks.
So you've taken profits, but then you've re-entered now. It looks a bit more...
Well, I mean, I'm talking about tactically. I mean, the shape of the portfolio hasn't changed significantly over the last year. You know, Davis, in terms of how we manage the, you know, the recovery portfolios, you know, these are focused on medium to long-term wealth creation. And the key factors that we look to exploit are value recovery, multi-cap. The portfolios I run, you know, will always have, you know, traditional value support and trade cheap versus their benchmark from a kind of price to book or price to sale. So it's kind of classic quick hand ways of looking at where the portfolio is a value portfolio. So we'll, you know, always had that, but then there's always going to be an element of you know, tactical, and, you know, tactically we were looking to take some capital out of some of the real winners of the last year towards, you know, Q1 this year, and you know, we're putting capital back into those stocks because some have retraced 10%, 20%, 30%.
And as I mentioned at the start, you do run the UK fund, but of course you also have a global fund. It'd be interesting to get your perspective on the UK. I suppose it's had kind of several wins in the last year. It's had kind of many reasons to be unloved in recent years, and then I suppose several reasons to kind of come roaring back. Is that still the most interesting market in terms of kind of value investing, or is there something else that's catching your eye a bit more?
Yeah, I mean, from a value perspective, I mean, the UK is standout, really. I mean, it has rallied over the last year, but still, you know, remains a laggard. As you mentioned, I do run global funds. You know, it's clear looking at, you know, regions around the world, which regions are expensive. The US, because it's the cheerleader for those big growth stocks, and has had great fundamentals over the last 10 years, because it's the cheerleader for that popular part of the market. It trades pretty expensive or very expensive. And then you go around the world, and the real laggard, I suppose, is the UK, because the UK, because of its benchmark makeup, is probably the cheerleader for value. You know, it's got a big component of financials, of energy, of pharmaceuticals, and those fit into the kind of value camp. And then, as you suggested, the last 5 years, you know, essentially post the referendum, the UK background, economic background, political background has been one of, you know, quite significant uncertainty. And as we know, investors don't like uncertainty. So that combination of being a value benchmark with that uncertainty element has meant that, you know, UK equities have very significantly derated versus other markets around the world, and looks really cheap on, you know, from an absolute perspective. So if you look at, you know, after 1 year of recovered earnings, UK market's trading on only about 13 times earnings, with, you know, an attractive free cash flow yield and a decent dividend yield, as, you know, the likes of banks starting distributing capital again. So you've got some really attractive absolute valuation metrics for the UK. And then you've got, you know, some of these uncertainties having been, you know, parked, I suppose, or essentially historical, the referendum and then Brexit, that's essentially in the past. And, you know, the political background is relatively stable. And then, you know, the UK, having had a difficult COVID, is recovering pretty aggressively. So we've got strong economic recovery and strong profits recovery for UK PLC to look forward to over the next 2 to 3 years. So modest starting valuation and strong, pretty strong fundamentals. And then within that, you know, we run a UK recovery portfolio, which, you know, trades cheap versus a cheap benchmark. And we've got companies that should really grow their, you know, decent quality franchises, which should grow their profits significantly over the next few years. So, yeah, I'm pretty bullish about UK. I mean, and that's in a context of, you know, a relatively expensive world out there. We can all find assets and equities that, you know, clearly not cheap or clearly pretty expensive, trade expensive versus their historical multiples or versus their ability to generate profits and cash flow. So there's lots of expensive stuff out there. So I find it really quite heartening that one can still put a portfolio in, you know, together that, you know, genuinely attractively valued and has decent profits prospects.
Mm. And in the UK, what kind of stocks and what sectors are you finding most exciting, or you think have kind of the biggest scope for substantial gains in the next few years or so?
Yeah, I'll definitely take you through some of those. Maybe just a very quick reminder of, you know, the philosophy and process, you know, that underlines, you know, the UK recovery fund and global recovery fund. You know, just by way of background, you know, the UK recovery fund was set up at the back end of the global financial crisis. So the idea was then there were, you know, a huge number of companies where profits had been negatively impacted but by that economic downturn. So a lot of recovery opportunities available. And then the Global Recovery Fund, which is the sister fund of UK recovery, was actually put in place back end of the European sovereign debt crisis. So we're very much led by investment opportunities. The funds focus on value recovery and multi-cap investing. So, you know, looking to invest from the largest companies down to really quite micro-cap companies. But, you know, a little bit different from, you know, traditional deep value managers, our philosophy, which we put in place, you know, when before we were managing any money back in 06, is called PVT, short for potential valuation and timing. So it's a bit more rounded. The three factors that we're looking for: potential, saying we want to buy companies where we're confident that, you know, shareholder value potential is significant, i.e. they can grow profits and cash flow. Valuation, you know, from a traditional school of value investing, wanting to pay 50p for a pound worth of medium-term intrinsic value. Also, you know, valuation backed up by, you know, attractive spot valuation metrics such as earnings yields and free cash flow yields. And then importantly, we look at this timing element, and we use quantitative and fundamental indicators of timing, which I think is really important for the recovery side of things. So you don't want to be buying something just because it's cheap. That's a reasonable reason for buying it, and typically buying things cheap, you know, has generated alpha over the years. But I think that shouldn't be the only reason. So we're looking for potential valuation and also timing. So indicators that the fortunes of a company have bottomed out. You know, that's profitability bottoming out and starting to beat expectations, and share price technicals. So the share price bottoming out and starting to beat expectations. And for recovery stocks, you know, clear evidence the management understand what they need to deliver. So, you know, that's the philosophy, a little bit different from traditional value. Sorry for that long background. And just you know, moving on to, you know, where we see the kind of key opportunities today. I mean, we do see value in lots of places, both UK, which I'll focus on, but also global. Just segmenting the portfolio in terms of the opportunity set. First of all, you know, deep traditional value. So that's short duration stocks that, you know, typically will benefit from higher interest rates. So, you know, we're finding opportunities there and looking to allocate more capital. That would include the classics such as, you know, banks. So in the UK, NatWest and Lloyds. And then looking globally, banks like Santander and actually some of the emerging market banks like Bangkok Bank. And then insurance companies, Old Mutual in the UK, which is very lowly valued, essentially exposed to South Africa and African life insurance. But with a big holding in a bank, and actually it's crystallizing value by selling some of its banking holdings. So there's the catalyst there for you know, the value gap to reduce. So that's the traditional deep value area. Classic recovery stocks, we'd be talking about things like you know, Whitbread, so hotel operators. So they operate the Premier Inns franchise, you know, which is taking market share because, you know, budget hotels, you know, typically over the last few years have been taking share in the UK, and they've got a very strong franchise. Clearly, hotels haven't been an easy place to be over the last 18 months, but they're starting to see occupancy pick up and, you know, profits growth should be robust over the next 2 to 3 years. And then they've got this growth engine in Germany as well, which is underpenetrated in terms of budget hotels. Other types of reopening plays. So one good example would be Restaurant Group, which is, you know, one of the biggest owners of restaurants. That's what it says on the tin. Surprising, but it actually owns the Wagamama chain, which is, you know, a good growth franchise. And, you know, again, with reopening, they're obviously going to see much better use of their you know, physical sites, but they've also grown, you know, the delivery element to the franchise during lockdown. So they've actually got, you know, a benefit from you know, people coming back to their physical restaurants, but also being able to continue to grow the delivery side. And then there've been a lot of casualties in the restaurant industry. Capacity's been withdrawn, and that means the terms of trade for the guys that remain have strengthened. You know, the ability to negotiate with property landlords, for example, they're in a much better place than they were a few years ago. Whether that's for existing restaurants or as they look to grow the restaurant chain. So, you know, that's in a good position. So classic recovery stock, and then with, you know, medium term growth characteristics. Then UK domestics have, you know, derated again over the last month or two, and that creates another opportunity. So we're buying back into house builders. So house builders would have been one of the areas that we're probably taking profits. If you go back Q1 this year, they've retraced quite a lot. And we see an opportunity there actually with a focus on Berkeley, which, you know, is pretty heavily focused on London. And London's been quite a laggard versus the regions for well-known reasons over the last couple of years. But we think London's going to be back. So see that as an opportunity. And they're following on from London coming back. We like, you know, some real estate in London, Capital & Counties in particular, which controls Covent Garden real estate market. And we just think Covent Garden is, you know, it's an iconic place in London where people like to hang out in normal times, and will love to hang out again over the next 2 to 3 years. And then they're taking some of the shops, you know, they've ended up with some more luxury boutique-y types of shops alongside, you know, the places to eat and the more social types of shops. And that's allowing them to push up rents over the medium term. It trades at a, you know, decent discount to quite depressed assets. So we see that as really attractive. So hopefully that gives you, you know, some ideas of the opportunities, and I can give you some more global ones if we want to go down that path.
Sticking with the UK for now, how, I suppose one sector, you've mentioned a lot of consumer facing sectors there. But one sector that you haven't directly mentioned that fund managers perhaps have been put off a bit in the last year is retail. You know, some people have finally just totally given up on retail in the last year because they just don't like the unpredictability, and it's very difficult, I think, to pick the winners there. How do you feel on that space?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, retail divides into, you know, bricks and mortar and online. Obviously, I don't think you want to be going anywhere close to, you know, pure bricks and mortar retailers. Probably, I mean, that, you know, see, value managers have to talk about value traps and, you know, retailers that have not been able to move into a digital environment to have a digital platform to run alongside their physical stores, you know, continue to, I think, be clear value traps. That said, there is relatively rare that there's a listed retailer now that doesn't have a reasonably robust digital platform. So those value traps are, you know, quite small. So yeah, I mean, we're comfortable. We've been comfortable investing, you know, more capital into retail, but we probably have more in you know, some of the e-commerce plays than we do in bricks and mortars or omni-channel plays. Actually, one of our favorite stocks over last year has been ASOS. Which actually, if you look at its EV to sales, trades on a really pretty low valuation, you know, a discount to traditional retailers. You know, over the last few years, it's had one or two issues. And because of that, it's kind of classic recovery play. It's got a decent market position in the UK, Europe, extending its franchise into the US pretty successfully. And obviously benefiting from lockdown. Bought in some new brands pretty attractively from some of the bricks and mortar operators that struggled. So yeah, we like that one for example.
And another, I suppose, fairly kind of divisive sector that's prominent in the UK is oil and gas. How do you generally approach kind of the energy sector and the oil and gas space?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think like all fund managers, you know, clearly you need to consider sustainability elements for you know, all the right reasons in terms of the world needing to become more sustainable, but also for financial reasons in the, you know, businesses that aren't sustainable from that perspective are clearly going to have higher risk premiums. So you need to take that into account. At River and Mercantile, we've put in place our own ESG philosophy. We call it sustainable PVT, that runs alongside our core PVT approach. So we look at all our stocks through that additional lens. Now, the energy sector is, you know, clearly actually a classic value and recovery sector. So as for value and recovery managers, we don't want to just park it and say we can't invest in it. And we don't do that because, you know, the fundamentals are strong at the moment for the energy market. Oil price, like other commodities, has been strong, and the fundamentals look strong because there's been so little investment in terms of producing carbon, producing oil over the last few years, and there's very little investment at the moment. So the kind of demand supply dynamics look positive. And then the companies that operate in that space, you know, are lowly valued. So they are classic value and recovery plays. But we need to take into account that second lens, sustainability. So our focus in that space, we're a little bit overweight versus the benchmark, which means we have 8% of the portfolio, UK. Globally, we have about 4.5%, so a little bit overweight versus benchmark, with a focus on, you know, companies that have clearly communicated how they're moving their energy production from being 100% carbon to other areas of greener energy production. So, you know, that would be our focus. It's on the improvers, and that would be our whole approach to sustainability. We have value and recovery managers. It'd be wrong for us to exclude stocks, but we need to think about it, and we think about it in the lens, in the context of improvers, companies that are clearly explaining how they're how they're improving their approach to sustainability.
Moving on to your kind of, I suppose, more general approach, something we write a lot about is the behavioral element of investing, which is obviously quite difficult, lots of traps there. Being a value manager, I suppose you have to almost have nerves of steel in this space, because as you've said, it's been a very difficult decade, lots of periods of kind of underperformance, and your kind of your approach means that you are not necessarily going into those big winners like, say, the FANGs in the global space. But how do you kind of stick to your guns when the market is not really going the way that would favor what you hold?
Yeah, I mean, there's two elements to that. I mean, the first element is that you've got to stay, I think, as a fund manager, you know, you have to stay in the game. You know, you can't afford to be too narrow in terms of your philosophy. That means that you know, during the difficult times for your philosophy, you really do struggle, and you're significantly behind the benchmark with all the pressures associated with that. So you need to stay in the game, and I think the way we've done that is by having a broader approach to value than traditional deep value managers. So I've talked about, you know, potential valuation and timing. So the potential and timing alongside buying things cheaply, the multi-cap nature of our approach, you know, which means that we've benefited from premium returns generated by small cap companies. The fact that we do think about, you know, the big picture cycle, so we didn't get overexcited by, you know, theoretically cheap UK domestic stocks post the referendum. We were actually cautious about the UK cycle at that point because UK economy had recovered pretty aggressively from the global financial crisis, and a lot of the domestic stocks had done particularly well. So we thought it was too early. So having that, you know, top down element. So there's various parts of the philosophy and process have allowed us to stay in the game and generate, you know, pretty robust returns, UK in particular, globally also. Globally harder because just the nature of the global benchmark, so dominated by US equities, so dominated by mega cap growth stocks, particularly difficult benchmark for value and recovery managers, but we still stayed in the game. So that's the first element in terms of answering your question. The second, you're quite right, it has been an emotional roller coaster for value and recovery managers. I think it was particularly difficult, you know, Q1 last year when we went into 2020 with the outlook looking more robust, with interest rates kind of trending upwards, value starting to do better, and then everything changed kind of almost overnight with the pandemic. So you saw another leg down after 10 difficult years for value, which was particularly trying. I think most value managers found that really quite emotional. But you then have to, stick with your approach. If you have a clear philosophy and process, and if you're like us, you've been applying that approach for 20 plus years, you know that it works. You have faith in it. You just stick with it day in, day out. And then you have the support of, the platform that you work within, the business that you work within, most importantly, the team and the individuals that you work with who are there to support you during those difficult times. And then, you do have fund management can be a lonely business every so often. And you have to have the DNA to be able to manage that loneliness during the difficult times and just stick with your approach. So yeah, that's one. That is what one has had to do over the last few years. But you get the rewards if you stick to that approach. The last year, as you kindly described at the beginning, returns have been strong, and the recovery funds are annualizing at 12-13%. Plus per annum since inception. So, those are returns that, create a decent amount of wealth for our clients. And that's what it's all about. Not necessarily straight line, but over the medium to long term, attractive numbers. And I'm a significant investor in the strategies myself. So, obviously one benefits personally from those, attractive medium to long term returns by sticking with the approach.
I suppose on the other hand, there is an argument perhaps that critics might say that at least in the last decade, the value approach, holding a value fund, has been almost around the kind of market timing. If you had it at the right points, then you've made phenomenal returns, but then you've had to kind of put up with underperforming for quite a sustained period of time. And can you actually make a case for a value fund as a kind of core holding, or is it more something you want alongside different styles?
I think most wealth managers or asset allocators, guardians of other people's capital, would put value a lot alongside other styles. So classically, growth or quality managers, the well known, very well known managers in that space. So you put value alongside as a good diversifier. But I think, I don't think the last 10 years, if you look pre the global financial crisis, pre the last 10 years, it was rare for value to underperform, but for more than 1 or 2 years, they were relatively isolated incidents for cheap stocks to underperform. So I think the last 10 years has been an exception rather than the norm. For various reasons, which have been, fully described by many people over the last few years as to why, value has particularly struggled over the last 10. I do think the next 5 to 10 years will be different. Will be much more supportive of value, or there's certainly much more balance in terms of value versus growth or quality, much more balanced. One reason for that, we've already talked about just a slightly different environment in terms of the economic background, nominal GDP running at a stronger rate than it has done post GFC, which will mean that the interest rate and bond yield environment will be more supportive. And then kind of some of the kind of classic, growth beneficiaries. I mean, some of them have become so large, they're trillion-dollar companies. At some point, the level of growth that they've delivered over the last 10 years is going to be sustainable going forward. I think it'd be harder to sustain. So some of their really strong fundamentals, I think, are likely to wane. And value and recovery stocks, fundamentals will be really pretty strong over the next 2 to 3 years. So yeah, I think it'd be much more balanced, and the periods of underperformance will be much less dramatic and more short-lived than they have been over the last 10 years. And so it's right, I think, to have good value managers, good value and recovery managers alongside other types of managers, and to be comfortable that actually you're going to get less volatility than one has had over the last 10 years.
Mm. You mentioned we have names like the FANGs have kind of dominated returns in a global context in the US. in your global fund, you know, you're notably, and perhaps unsurprisingly, you're notably underweight to the US. US is such a huge component of the MSCI World Index nowadays. But where do you, you know, where do you actually find the opportunities? You know, what actually stands out if you're essentially having to kind of ignore some of those stocks that have led the way for so long and have become so overpowering in markets?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a good point. I mean, you know, it's not like we don't like the US. I mean, we actually have, even global recovery has 30% in the US. So, you know, some by far our biggest allocation regionally. But, you know, in the context of wanting to run a genuinely global portfolio and look for PVT recovery opportunities all around the world, and to offer our clients something really quite different, I think. And then in the context of the fact that we all know US equities are quite expensive, just look at cyclically adjusted PEs, they are high versus history, and they are quite dominated by, you know, the loved parts of the market, you know, those fangs as we talk about them. Mm. So it's just right, I think, to take a, from our perspective as value and recovery managers, to take a broader approach and to hunt all around the world. And you know, the fantastic opportunities I mentioned earlier, you know, in a relatively expensive world, it's great to be able to find, you know, good franchises on genuinely attractive valuations. And one can find lots of those around the world. So where are we overweight elsewhere? We're overweight the UK, but as a UK, historically UK fund manager, I haven't wanted that to dominate our portfolio. So we have 8 or 9% in the UK. We've got decent exposure to Europe. I mean, Europe is a classic high beta play on economic recovery. And valuations are more modest, and there are some laggard parts of Europe which are playing catch up and are well supported by you know, fiscal support. So areas like, you know, Italy, and Italy's got a really a, you know, exciting digital. It's lagged in that whole area, but they're investing aggressively in digital, and they've got some, you know, pretty young businesses that are growing at a clip and hardly have any coverage. So we find that, you know, those, that area interesting. Asia Pacific, we find interesting. I mean, China, you know, one area I'm kind of banging the table on, you know, is actually, you know, the Chinese internet stocks, which have lagged incredibly over the last year versus their US peers. And things like, you know, Baidu, actually it's probably the cheapest mega cap stock I've ever seen in my career. You know, its market cap is if you strip out cash and some equity holdings that it has in quoted businesses, its value is about $45 billion. You compare that with, you know, the equivalents in the US, which are 500 billion trillion businesses, and that market cap is justified by its, you know, traditional search business, where it has a 70% market share. So that business alone, you know, pays for your equity. And then you've got the, you know, number one artificial intelligence platform in China, the number one autonomous vehicle platform in China, and the number three cloud business behind Alibaba and Tencent in China. So you've got some three really strong platforms which should show huge growth over the next few years, and you've got all that for free. You know, that's an example of, you know, mispricing, I think, extreme mispricing around the world that we're, you know, we're kind of here to exploit. So Asia Pacific and emerging markets. I suppose we're overweight a lot of the rest of the world and underweight the US. But as I wanted to say, I mean, it's not that we don't like the US. There's always lots of opportunities to buy stocks in the US. And we do have 30% of the portfolio there. But we want to provide a genuinely global value and recovery portfolio.
Mm. Well, very interesting stuff there. I'm afraid that's all we have time for. Thank you, Hugh, very much for joining us today. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Searching for the perfect gift idea for that hard-to-buy person on your list? The Allbirds Wool Runner is a natural fit. The Wool Runner is super cozy, super comfy, and super giftable. It's made with ZQ-certified merino wool, a naturally cozy material that offers next-level comfort and a lower environmental impact. The cushioned midsole and versatile design offer all-day comfort in a classic style you can wear every day, even in a winter wonderland. And its fully machine-washable construction makes it easy to keep your shoes looking like new. Allbirds shows off the Wool Runner's carbon footprint right on the shoe so you can see the difference for yourself. On top of that, they actually offset that carbon footprint to zero, making the Wool Runner completely carbon neutral, so you can stay cozy and tread lighter on the planet. This holiday season, give tidings for comfort and coziness with the Allbirds Wool Runner. Discover your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.